why is the speech, why does it become known as lost? Well, a story goes that the so-called fervid brilliancy of Lincoln's words, right, led the reporters that were there and others that were taking notes or doing a transcription to just drop their pens and live in the moment of inspiration, and let Lincoln's words just melt over you. Well, as Michael Burlingame says, a well-known Lincoln historian, that really doesn't pass the smell test, right?
One of the most examined figures in American history, if not world history, is Abraham Lincoln. So how can a pivotal point in Lincoln's career become overlooked and one of his speeches become lost? This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today, we're talking with a historian who will talk about Lincoln's lost speech given in Bloomington, Illinois in 1856. It's a moment that was a pivotal one for the nation and the formation of the Republican Party in opposition to slavery.
I'm Bill Kemp. I'm the librarian in the nonprofit McLean County Museum of History. I've been at the museum for 21 years now. I used to teach part-time at Heartland in the social studies history field, a class a semester or so, but I haven't done that in a decade or so. But I have turned my attention now to adult learning, and I find that very stimulating. There's always great conversation and questions and dialogue, so I always look forward to the, and I'm especially looking forward to Lincoln's lost speech because it's interesting on its face. You just hear the term lost speech and you're already drawn in. Abraham Lincoln, of course, speaks for himself, but the story itself, once you open up the book, is the most fascinating thing about it by a long shot.
May 29th, 1856, Lincoln gives this speech. For those of us who aren't historians or even the more fervent students of history, please place this timeline in Lincoln's career.
Sure.
What was going on in the country and with Abraham Lincoln in the spring of 1856?
Wonderful question. So to place Lincoln, the man, in context of the 1850s, which is his time of maturation as a political leader, as a moral voice for the nation, as he steers the country, as the country's torn asunder by the issue of slavery. The 1850s, right? So Lincoln will butt heads, will face off against his political nemesis, Stephen A. Douglas, the Democratic senator, U.S. senator from Illinois, the little giant, so-called because of his stature, little giant because he was probably the most formidable, respected, and powerful politician nationally in the antebellum period, that is, pre-Civil War. But Stephen A. Douglas and Abraham Lincoln stood on opposite ends of the issue when it came to slavery and its future and how that would shape the nation. So in 1854, Stephen A. Douglas shepherds through Congress passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And that threatens then to open slavery into heretofore free northern territories. It repealed the Missouri Compromise. And for people like Abraham Lincoln, who at this time were Whigs, right? We know Lincoln as a Republican. Lincoln as the first Republican president in American history. But for most of his adult life, his political life, he was a Whig. But just as slavery will tear the nation apart, slavery will tear political parties apart. And Lincoln's beloved Whig Party, the party of pro-business and westward expansion and a central bank and internal improvements and promoting education, that party, right, was torn asunder by the weight of slavery. So northern Whigs like Abraham Lincoln were looking elsewhere, and passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the threat to open slavery into northern territories where, with the Missouri Compromise of 1820, Lincoln and others thought that issue, that door had been closed, right? But now it had been opened again. And here we go. Lincoln believed at this time in the 1850s that slave power, the slaveocracy of the South carried too much political weight. The intentions of the founding fathers, Abraham Lincoln believed, were to hem this appalling system of human bondage, slavery, where it existed, and hope that it would wither and die on the vine. But yet here we are in the 1850s, slave power is ascendant and looking to expand. So passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, the ripples of that then will lead to the creation of what we know as the Republican Party 2 years later, and that's where we find ourselves. In the spring of 1856, slavery ripping the nation apart, right, North and South. And in the North, political leaders and voters are looking for a new movement to halt this expansion of slavery. So anti-slavery Whigs such as Abraham Lincoln, anti-slavery Northern Democrats such as William Bissell, who will become the first Republican governor in the state of Illinois. Abolitionists will be a natural ally of this new political movement, soon to be the Republican Party. Know-nothings. What are know-nothings? They're nativist, nationalist, anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant. They're known as the American Party. They will run a pretty formidable race in 1856. Nonetheless, a lot of the adherents of the Know-Nothing or American Party will tend to coalesce along with this new anti-slavery expansion party. And why is that? Because these nativists, these members of the Know-Nothing Party, they believe that slavery represented the threat to free labor, free native labor, right? So they were, again, an allies. And you also drew in German immigrants who were flooding into the United States after the failed revolution in the German states, Democratic Revolution of 1848. So you have liberty-loving Germans coming to the United States, and they're going to be natural allies of this new political movement, soon to be a party, coalescing from the impact of the Kansas-Nebraska Act passed in 1854. So throughout the North, northern states in the spring of 1856, you have organizing what were known initially as anti-Nebraska parties, right? And that's what happens on May 29th, 1856. It's a one-day political convention of the Anti-Nebraska Party of Illinois. They will not take the banner of the Grand Old Party or the Republican Party until several months later. So 1854, passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. 1856, formation of these anti-slavery expansion parties, right, comprised of both moderates and radicals like abolitionists. There's always kind of this parlor game in local history circles for states or communities to claim to be the birthplace of the Republican Party nationally. That's because organically, these movements were occurring on a state level throughout the spring of 1856. Illinois will come a little bit later than, say, Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, two states that claim to be the birthplace. Nonetheless, we know Bloomington is the birthplace of the Illinois Republican Party, right? Because that party is born on May 29th, 1856, with a keynote address that will later be known as Lincoln's Lost Speech.
With this site, why did they come to Bloomington, Illinois? Why was that the place where all of these disparate groups of anti-Nebraska Act folks, why Bloomington?
Delegates were invited from all counties throughout the state, and there were 250 delegates all told. Although some southern Illinois counties did not send delegates because there was precious little support for this new party in the deep in Little Egypt in southern Illinois, which has always been more conservative, more aligned with interests in the southern states than, say, the middle or northern tier of the states. Why was Bloomington picked? I don't know the exact answer. I suspect because it was centrally located, had railroad access. Lincoln himself, I believe, he's practicing law in Danville a few days before this political convention. He takes a train to Decatur and then will take the Illinois Central Railroad up from Decatur into Bloomington. So that's probably a reason. And this was a stronghold of this new political movement. P. people like Judge David Davis on the 8th Judicial Circuit, Jesse Fell, one of the founders of Normal, Leonard Sweat, a fellow attorney with Abraham Lincoln, and others were leaders of this new organization. So for probably several reasons, Bloomington was the site.
Who, other than Lincoln, spoke at this convention? What type of people were speaking, and did they only just talk about the issue of slavery, or did they have other issues that they wanted to coalesce this potential new party around?
Sure. So slavery wasn't the only issue, because they are organizing a new political party, so a platform has to be created. So there are other issues, economic interest and whatnot involved. Also, issues involved in immigration and issues such as that. So, but the primary focus, the reason for being there, of course, is the issue of slavery and specifically the threat of its expansion. Who else spoke there? It would have been leaders of this movement at the time from throughout the state, including Chicago. I mentioned William Bissell. He will be the governor, and he will win election in 1856. So this new political party will put up its first candidate for governor, William Bissell, a former Democrat. So this new political party is trying to appeal to all its different factions. Its Secretary of State, I believe, will be Francis Hoffman, a German immigrant. So again, you're appealing to one faction of this new political movement. It's just a one-day convention. Most of the business is taken care of in the morning and the afternoon, and then everybody reconvenes at, 5:30 in the evening to hear Abraham Lincoln speak, and he will speak for about 90 minutes. We know that he has notes in his hand, but he doesn't have anything like a full transcription of what he will say.
And this speech is something that, one of his contemporaries, a person who was his law partner, William Herndon, who sort of became a Lincoln historian contemporary historian of Lincoln. He said that this speech, he saw all of Lincoln's speeches, and this was the greatest speech or the grandest speech of Lincoln's life.
Right. William Herndon, who might have known Lincoln better than anybody, longtime law partner, they spent a tremendous amount of time, and Herndon really had an insight into Lincoln psychologically and otherwise. And he said it was his one of, or if not the greatest speech he ever had. This was the New Testament Abraham Lincoln for somebody like William Herndon. Prior to that, Herndon said Lincoln was arguing the issue of slavery primarily from the perspective of, say, a constitutional lawyer, litigating the issue. But on this night in downtown Bloomington, May 29, 1856, he was speaking to the converted, if you will, for the most part. And he got kind of carried away. Lincoln, from his boyhood, we know he opposed the institution of slavery. He always found it repugnant. He believed in the Declaration of Independence as being the founding document, right? Having the ancient faith, as he called it, in the founding fathers, in their belief that all men are created equal. And Lincoln believed truly that that was the mission. The United States wasn't quite there. There was much work left to do, but that was the guiding principle. So he certainly got carried away to some extent, right? Because this new political party, soon to be called the Republican Party, they wanted to put kind of this veneer of moderation before the Northern voter, right? They didn't want to scare people away. They didn't want to be the party of abolitionism. In fact, Abraham Lincoln, right, made it a point to say, I'm not an abolitionist, right? He believed slavery was morally repugnant, was opposite to the core values, right, of the United States, but yet it was constitutionally protected, right? So there were ways to restrict it, and you certainly must not let it expand. If you hem it in, again, wither and die on the vine, because he believed slavery could not compete with free labor. So he saw it more as a long game. The Civil War would certainly change that equation. So Lincoln was at his finest, right? He was speaking not so much from he wasn't litigating the issue, he was speaking as a Old Testament preacher. And why is the speech, why does it become known as lost? Well, a story goes that, and William Herndon played into this legend and lore as well, and others, that the so-called fervid brilliancy of Lincoln's words, right, led the reporters that were there and others that were taking notes or doing a transcription to just drop their pens and live in the moment, live in the moment of inspiration, and let Lincoln's words just melt over you. Well, as Michael Burlingame says, a well-known Lincoln historian, that really doesn't pass the smell test, right?
It's hard to imagine even the regional reporters becoming so enraptured with the speech that they stopped taking notes. Were there media there that, what was that like? What type of people would cover this sort of event?
So, you know, newspapers were, this was, you know, a period of great newspaper culture in American history. And newspapers were usually known as political organs. They were tied to specific political parties. So we do know there were newspaper reporters there. So probably a better answer for why the speech is lost, though there are other answers, some more a little more sophisticated in their analysis. One answer would be self-censorship, right? As I said, Lincoln got carried away. This wasn't kind of the voice of moderation they wanted to project to maybe leery voters who weren't quite sure about this anti-slavery expansion party, right? Maybe anti-slavery Democrats that were still comfortable in the Democratic Party and weren't quite ready to make the leap to this new party. So the idea that the reporters that were there, anti-Nebraska newspapers, soon to be known as Republican newspapers, kind of tamped down what Lincoln said. Certainly there was reports of large sections or sections of what Lincoln said, but you really don't get much of the force, kind of this Old Testament fervor that you hear from people that were there. And certainly, right, local historians like myself, we always have to be careful not to make too much of events that occur in your community, right? That's an easy fault, that anything that happens here is the most important thing. But this is certainly one of Lincoln's greatest speeches. And it certainly is reported as such by the people that were there. Ida Tarbell, we know her as kind of a muckraking journalist, but Ida Tarbell was also, in her day, a Lincoln scholar. And she was fascinated with Lincoln's speaking style, Lincoln's voice, and his speeches. And she, when she would interview people, and she was around at the time where there were still plenty of people around that knew Lincoln, and she would always talk to them about speeches that they heard about his voice, things of that nature. And people would often tell Tarbell, and this is Tarbell's reading or account of it, they would say, oh, this speech was wonderful, this speech was wonderful, but if you weren't there to hear the lost speech, you would never have had a sense of really the magic that Lincoln could bring to the podium. So Tarbell knew, was always interested in this lost speech. So it kind of captivated Lincoln scholars as early as the late 1800s.
Nowadays, if a politician gives a big speech, they have a printed copy that they disseminate amongst the media. So a lot of times the media will know what's going to be in the speech before the speech is even given. I don't think it was a preemptive thing back in Lincoln's time, but there was no recording happening back then in the 1850s. You had to get close, not a lot of amplified voices, so people would hand out a written out version of it to the media. Apparently this didn't happen, though, for the lost speech.
Correct. Yeah, there are examples of people having copies of Lincoln speeches, or at least versions of that, prior to the speech, I believe. So what did Lincoln say that night? Well, that, you know, we do have some newspaper accounts to give us glimpses of that miraculous night. For example, the Weekly Courier of Alton, the week after this anti-Nebraska convention, reports that Lincoln was here ready to fuse with anyone who would unite with him to oppose slave power. And they quote Lincoln as saying, "The Union must be preserved in the purity of its principles as well as the integrity of its territorial parts." In other words, Lincoln was arguing that it wasn't just the Union. To keep the Union whole wasn't enough, right? This was an experiment in a Republican form of government, of liberty, of democracy. And if you did not have the purity of principles which to strive for, it wasn't a country worth fighting for. So there you get a little bit of a glimpse of Lincoln. He says, or perhaps he shouts, in his kind of peculiar tinny voice that he has. We often think Lincoln must have had this deep baritone voice, but he actually had, we believe from firsthand accounts, a very tinny voice that could project very well. And he said, and he was quoting in a way the great orator Daniel Webster, "It must be liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable." Again, union, yes, but liberty. Without liberty, there is no union. So there we get a glimpse. For me, the true lost speech is found in the Belleville Weekly Advocate, another weekly paper down in the Metro East area on this side of the Mississippi River across from St. Louis. And during the speech, according to the account again in the Belleville Weekly Advocate, Lincoln criticizes members of his own party. He was still a Whig at that time, right? And he called them national Whigs, a term for members of his party who, in the name of national unity, refused to fuse with Lincoln because they thought that's too sectional, right? They wanted to remain a national party. But Lincoln said these conservative Whigs, who were fearful of antagonizing the South, embraced union at the cost of what? Aiding and abetting the expansion of slavery. So this account in the Belleville Weekly Advocate says, quote, "National Whigs," Lincoln is saying, "are all the time stepping about to the music of the Union." Lincoln had no doubt but that the music of an overseer's lash upon a mulatto girl's back would make some of them dance a Virginia hornpipe. "Let them step," said Lincoln, "let them dance to the music of the Union, while we, my old Whig friends, stand fast by principle and freedom and the Union together." So I think here, at last, is at least a glimpse of the power of Lincoln on that night on May 29th, 1856, right in downtown Bloomington. He's telling to his fellow Whigs, conservative Whigs, that to remain a national party is a danger because you're aiding, abetting slavery. The music you think you're hearing of the Union is actually the lashes upon an enslaved person's back. And Lincoln said, "We will listen to the real music of the Union by creating this new political movement."
It's interesting to contrast that with the challenge that he would have then to keep the Union whole as president, as the Confederacy wanted to break free and keep those practices and that form of their independence. So then Lincoln would be saying, we have to keep the entire Union together.
Right. He strongly believed, as much as perhaps anybody who ever occupied the White House, in both, in Union and liberty, and hundreds of thousands would die for that cause. Now, it's interesting here. The term lost speech really doesn't begin to appear until the late 1800s, turn of the last century. And as John G. Nicolay says, one of Lincoln's great personal secretaries, says, you call this the lost speech, but he had given at least 50 other campaign addresses in 1856 as he was stumping for John C. Fremont, the Republican presidential candidate who will lose to James Buchanan, and he was stumping for other Republicans as well. 50 or so speeches, there's no transcriptions of those, so those are also lost, right? Well, one of the reasons, I think, this speech becomes so-called the law speech is, right, what does Lincoln talk about that night? He talks about enslaved people. He talks about slavery, right? He talks about this evil that is tearing the nation apart, which the nation in the 1850s is embracing, wants to see expanded. That's the message maybe later manifestations of the Republican Party really don't want to emphasize, right? So by the 1920s, 1930s, as the law speech, or as this important event, this establishment of the Republican Party, is being celebrated in anniversaries every spring, the tendency is to really ignore the message, right? To just emphasize that the birth of the Republican Party, to emphasize kind of the magical speech-making of Lincoln, though we won't mention specifics of what he said that day. They'll talk about kind of his backwoods background, prairie lawyer, kind of his humor. They'll talk about many things about Lincoln, the man, his life and career, but they won't really talk about in these anniversaries slavery and race. And this community will plaque to death Majors Hall. Majors Hall is the building where this convention is held. It's held on the third floor of a building located at East and Front Streets in downtown Bloomington. The building is torn down in 1959 for parking, so that's an old story in downtown Bloomington.
You don't have any account other than these various contemporaneous accounts of this. And because of that, the story maybe shifts a little bit over time and the importance of it. Yeah. And what was said.
And like many things with history, right, our understanding of the past is often a reflection more of our current interests or needs or passions or prejudices than it is really about the past. And we're making the same mistakes today. We just really don't know it. Hopefully not as bad as the mistakes made in the past, but live and let learn, I guess. So this community, as it thought about, as it commemorated what is arguably probably the most important event locally that impacts the nation, right? This is Lincoln's, in many ways, the birth of Lincoln as the moral voice to oppose the expansion of slavery, right? The Republican Party is founded here, right? And that will give him the launching pad to face off against Douglas in 1858 for Senate and then again against Douglas in 1860 for president. So this community, how did it commemorate, right, this important emotional, historically deep event, right? You know, it sidestepped it, right? We put various plaques on or next to the building over the years, but there was never a plaque that really told the story. And what's the story of Lincoln's lost speech? The story is that Illinoisans gathered from throughout the state about 250 delegates to what? To address the issue of enslavement and black slavery and the expansion of slavery in this country and its future. That was the story, and that's the story this community really did not want to emphasize until rather recently. And the approach has certainly changed over the last 20 or 30 years. There's a really nice Looking for Lincoln wayside or signage now at the site of former Majors Hall that gives a much more accurate depiction of the issues that were wrestled over at the time.
And that site is, as you mentioned, a parking garage, which itself is in need a little repair. Just an aside there, looking back, so you said that how long did Majors Hall survive as a building? You said maybe into the 50s?
Yeah, Majors Hall itself is a fascinating story, right? So again, it was located at the corner of Front Street and East Street in downtown Bloomington. It was three stories. Majors Hall, very typical 1850s building. First story was for commercial dry goods store, grocery store, things of that nature. Second floor would be offices or light industry like textile work or things of that nature. And the third floor was the hall, so about 3,000 square feet or so. So you could pack about 1,000 people or so really tightly and hold meetings. People could give speeches. Traveling theater troupes could perform there. Fraternal societies could hold meetings there and whatnot. So on the third floor, that's where Lincoln gives the lost speech, the keynote address to the formation of the Illinois Republican Party in 1856. In 1872, the third floor, the floor where the address was given, is lost in a fire. They do save the lower two stories, and it remains occupied. In fact, the first floor is a Kroger grocery for a while, I think in the Great Depression and then a little bit later. But the building then is torn down in 1959. There is a kind of a debate because people realize the historic importance. There's actually a proposal to reconstruct the third floor. Think about how different downtown Bloomington would be today if we had a rebuilt Majors Hall. That would be in a very important stop for for Lincoln tourism, certainly. But it was taken down in 1959 for about a dozen or so parking spaces because the parking deck that's there will not come until later, right? Late 1950s, most middle-class families in Bloomington, normal at this time, have an automobile. Downtown Bloomington is still the shopping district, and people are desperate for more and more parking. In fact, they're so desperate, they're willing to tear down some of the more historic buildings for just a few parking spaces. If there is any bright spot about this whole thing, the loss of Majors Hall, that kind of awakens the community. It is the loss of Majors Hall and the loss of what's known as the Pillsbury Hill Mansion on East Olive. That will be taken down for the current City Hall. The loss of those two buildings and the loss of the Bloomington Coliseum will really kind of create a historic preservation ethos in this community.
As we look today at what immediately happened after this speech and after this convention, it's almost kind of hard to wrap one's head around in our two-party system today that the idea that such a young party would gain so much momentum in such a short period of time, really, after this 1856 convention, that you would have an offshoot party, a third party, present a candidate who would become governor within a year.
Again, I think that speaks to the weight of slavery in this nation's history. And for example, when I taught at Heartland Community College, I always made it the point, I think most professors and instructors should, that your political inclination should remain somewhat mysterious for class, right, for your students, right? It's really just gets in the way of things. And I really took pride in never letting and never preaching to students, right? That's just not, the classroom is not the place for that, right? But I did say there was one thing that really we couldn't argue much about, and that was that the Civil War, the cause of the Civil War was slavery, right? Because that's just an uncontested fact, right? And a lot of people don't want to face that because it's unpleasant, because much of history, the United States history, is unpleasant. But that doesn't mean when you address and examine those issues, that's somehow un-American, right? In fact, nothing could be more American than looking at our past, both good and bad. So certainly, if you look at the primary sources, look at the pages of the Weekly Pantograph in the 1850s, it's all about slavery and race. You look at the party that opposed this anti-Nebraska party, Stephen A. Douglas's Democratic Party, both North and South, virulently racist, right? The language that Douglas used, right, was just drenched in language that is unfit for this podcast, thankfully, right? The N-word was tossed about, right? What was one of the main Democratic Party's arguments in 1856 with the formation of this new Republican Party, right? They talk about, and this is, I'm being Stephen A. Douglas here, the Mr. Lincoln, my opponent, right, this new political party, they talk about wanting to halt the expansion of slavery. That's one thing, right? But what they're really about is abolition of the institution of slavery. Not only that, they're for the equality of the races. Not only that, they want black men to marry your daughters. So the threat of black male sexuality, right, was out in the forefront in the 1850s. So Stephen A. Douglas was playing the race card, playing it all the time. And newspapers that supported the Democratic Party in Bloomington, such as The Flag and The Times, were virulently racist as well. So how could a party in just a matter of months basically become a party that could compete on a national level as this anti-Nebraska slash Republican party did? I think, again, going back to slavery and this threat that the anti-Nebraska party posed to opening this institution of slavery into heretofore free northern territories was enough to get people motivated, was enough to create enough voters to coalesce into this new political party strong enough to oppose the Democrats come 1856. And in fact, in Illinois, Republicans will sweep statewide offices in 1856. So in the spring, the party's formed. In the fall, they are triumphant. John C. Fremont, the Republican candidate, though, does not carry Illinois. It will be James Buchanan. That we'll have to wait till 1860, 4 years later, for a Republican to carry Illinois. That, of course, will be Abraham Lincoln.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for coming in to talk about this really overlooked part of one of the most examined figures in American history, Abraham Lincoln. It's hard to believe there's an overlooked element to his career, but here I believe we have one that is a little bit that way. And thanks for coming in. People that are interested in learning even more about this, this class is in the Continuing Education Department at Heartland Community College and is a popular topic. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me and have me back.
Bill Kemp is librarian at McLean County's Museum of History in Bloomington, Illinois. He talked to us today about the subject of his continuing education class at Heartland Community College, Lincoln's Lost Speech. If you're interested in other interviews about history or other topics, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.